One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to Israel War Briefing, a podcast from the Jewish Chronicle, the oldest Jewish newspaper in the world. I'm Jake Wallace-Simons, editor of the Jewish Chronicle and author of Israelophobia, the newest version of the oldest hatred and what to do about it. In each episode, I have a one-to-one conversation with someone worth listening to.
This week, I am delighted to welcome Jason Brodsky to join us on the podcast. Jason is the policy director at United Against Nuclear Iran, a distinguished American think tank, and a non-resident scholar at the Middle East Institute's Iran program. He'll be helping us understand the often opaque world of the Islamic Republic of Iran, the main threat facing Israel, the wider Middle East, and indeed the West. So Jason, welcome. Thank you for joining us.
It's great to be with you, Jake, and the Jewish Chronicle. Thanks for having me.
So Jason, if you could, would you just map out for us the structure of the regime? Most people know the Ayatollah. They might know the IRGC and a few other figures, but not much more than that. But it's quite complicated, isn't it?
Yes, it is a complicated system with a number of moving parts, but at the top is the supreme leader. He is the constitutional commander-in-chief, and the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps and the Artesh, which is the regular military of the Islamic Republic, report to him, and he is the one who gives the orders.
And he's the Ayatollah Khomeini, is that how you pronounce it?
Khomeini.
Because there's different pronunciations. There's Khomeini and Khomeini.
Yes. Ruhollah Khomeini was the first supreme leader, and Ali Khamenei has been the second supreme leader since 1989. So you have him at the top, and then under him you have a body called the Supreme National Security Council, and that is an interagency process that's comprised of the president of the Islamic Republic, who is the chairman, technically, of the Supreme National Security Council, as well as the Minister of Foreign Affairs, the Intelligence Minister, the IRGC's chief commander is on there, the Artesh's chief commander is on there. You have other security agencies, the Ministry of Interior. So it's meant to come up with recommendations for the supreme leader on national security policy to form a consensus within the Iranian system. And at the end of the day, the supreme leader is the chief decision maker.
And tell me about the president, because he took over some years ago, and it was a bit of a sea change towards hardline culture, wasn't it?
Well, yeah, I think...
Even more hardline culture.
Yeah, exactly. I think oftentimes in the West, we make too much of a big deal over who the president of the Islamic Republic is. I think the president of the Islamic Republic is like a chief operating officer, essentially. He is an implementer of the Iran supreme leader's strategic direction and strategic decision making. And so that's how I would describe this person. I think that Ibrahim Raisi is certainly more hard line than his predecessor, Hassan Rouhani, who was considered a pragmatist in Tehran. But Raisi is no doubt much more of a traditional Khamenei-like character in the Islamic Republic. I would say Raisi is probably the president who has been the closest to Khamenei in terms of his view of the world and how he operates since 1989 when Khamenei became supreme leader. So that's very important.
And he's earned the nickname the Butcher of Tehran.
Yes. Ibrahim Raisi is actually one of the most qualified individuals in terms of resume to hold the presidency because he was chief justice before becoming president. And in the 1980s, he was on a death commission that greenlighted the executions of thousands of political prisoners in Iran, thus earning the nickname the Butcher of Tehran.
Right. And when he was elected, which was fairly recently, it wasn't just a few years ago.
2021.
He immediately appointed a cabinet of people who'd been sanctioned, who were on terror lists, who had Interpol red notices against them and so forth.
Yes, the cabinet is essentially a criminal syndicate. And you have a lot of very hardline figures there who have, as you mentioned, a very checkered past. Ahmad Vahidi is the interior minister. As some of your viewers may know, he is a subject of an Interpol red notice for his role in the bombing of the Amia Center in Buenos Aires in 1994. Raisi also brought back into the fold Mohsen Rezai, a former commander-in-chief of the IRGC, and who was also wanted as an Interpol red notice for the Buenos Aires bombing. So there are a whole host of characters who are circulating in the Raisi administration of this nature.
Okay, and so downwards from these top level guys, we've got various different arms of the security apparatus, both domestic and external. And my understanding is that they are, for one thing, hugely populated. I mean, they employ thousands upon thousands of people, and they sometimes work against each other as well as together. Is that right?
There is competition among the security services. There's competition between the IRGC and Artesh as well. The system...
Artesh is what?
Artesh is the regular military.
Right.
And so there is that competition there. It's built into the system. Redundancy is built into the system, especially in the intelligence community. Iran has two main intelligence agencies. One is the Ministry of Intelligence, whose head is nominally nominated by the president of the Islamic Republic and has to be confirmed by parliament. But in practice, the president is given a selection from the supreme leader of acceptable names, and he has to pick from those names. So that's the intelligence ministry. And at the same time, you have the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, who, as I mentioned earlier, is directly subordinate to the supreme leader.
Right. And within the IRGC, there's the Quds Force. Is that right?
Yeah. The IRGC is more than just the Quds Force. I think the IRGC has multiple branches. So I can describe that if that's useful. It has a ground force. It has an aerospace force. It has a navy. It has a Quds Force. It has an intelligence organization. That's the entity that competes with the intelligence ministry of Iran. And it also has multiple economic conglomerates like Khatam al-Anbiya construction headquarters, which is a cash cow for the IRGC and the regime. So there are a lot, it's a very big bureaucracy and a lot of moving parts.
And the IRGC mainly focuses outside of Iran's borders on creating havoc around the region and indeed further afield in the West. Tell me a little bit about the domestic security situation, because my understanding is that almost for every Iranian civilian, you've got an Iranian secret policeman watching him.
Yes, it's a highly securitized society. I think that the IRGC does have a domestic role as well. Right. And I'll give you an example. The IRGC has representatives in different agencies of state in the Islamic Republic to ensure that they are adhering to the ideological precepts of the Islamic Republic. And that's how it maintains the ideological purity of the regime, and has a kind of big brother mentality of watching over people and weeding out and purging undesirable elements. So there's that. I would also say that, you know, the security services have presence in every Iranian university as well. There's a professor's besiege organization, which is subservient to the IRGC. There's a student besiege organization in universities that's subservient to the IRGC. So you have all of this highly securitized architecture in place throughout the Iranian system.
Right. In fact, a couple of years ago, I was speaking to somebody who worked for the Mossad, and he was saying that, you know, they've famously penetrated Iranian society at almost every level. And he was saying that in a way it's easier because they're so busy watching their own people that they almost haven't got the capacity to watch for the real threat.
Yes, I think we can see that. And, you know, there are many foreign intelligence organizations who have impressive achievements in penetrating very sensitive areas of the Islamic Republic. And that's always a question that arises whenever a spectacular operation takes place and makes it into the media. You know, what happened to the Iranian security services? Where are they? The population in Iran tends to ask those questions, and they some of them, you know, joke in a very morbid way that, oh, they're concentrating on hijab enforcement and, you know, harassing dissidents abroad. So there's
but also, I think the other perhaps key to some of the success of these intelligence operations is that much of the population hates the regime. They're not representatives, as far as I understand it, of the majority of the population. But before we talk about that, can you just give me a sense of the cultural and theological flavor of the regime apparatus and its inhabitants? What do they believe? What do they want? What drives them? What holds them together? What's their kind of raison d'etre?
Well, they believe in the rule of the jurisprudent and the veliyat-e faqih. And that is subservience to the supreme leader, who is at the top of the system. They also believe, and it's in the Islamic Republic's constitution, in exporting the revolution. You know, I think that the Islamic Republic is not representative of Iran. The Islamic Republic is really a deviation in many respects from, you know, the proud, rich Iranian history that has been in place for a very long period of time. It's an anomaly. And that's what I think Western observers don't fully understand and appreciate. It you know, especially the IRGC, it's not a conventional armed force. It acts as an ideological army. And that's what I think people have to understand. It's the Islamic Revolution, the Islamic Republic acts as if it's a cause as opposed to a country. And that's, I think, the distinction that's important.
Right. So there's the cult of personality element to it, which you've just alluded to. But there's also, as far as I understand it, a millenarial aspect to it, this sort of hankering after, or not even hankering after, but forming a military strategy aimed at causing an apocalyptic war, which will bring a kind of messianic figure back from invisibility. Is that right?
Yeah, that's a cult of Mahdiism. Yes, that is absolutely prevalent in the regime. It drives the ideology of the Islamic Republic. And it has become very prevalent and prominent of late, particularly because of Ayatollah Khamenei purging the system to such an extent where those individuals who had served in some of the most sensitive positions in the Islamic Republic, like intelligence minister, former secretary of Supreme National Security Council, former speaker of parliament, they are not allowed to run for the presidency because of this desire to weed out undesirables and achieve a fully Islamic society and keeping with Ayatollah Khamenei's personal signature vision for right. Iran.
And so I think that perhaps is thought to be another reason why sometimes there's a lack of competence within the regime, because they weed out people who are competent but not ideologically pure in favor of the real insanely committed ideologues who might not have the skills.
Yes, as two of my colleagues at Iwani, Kasra Arabi and Saeed Golkar, have recently written, it's the dumbification of the Iranian political elite.
Right.
So that is there, and it's a real trend in the Islamic Republic right now.
So let's just talk a little bit about the Iranian people, because as distinct from the regime, how many of them support the regime? I mean, I'm sure it's a spectrum, but roughly, how many of them support the regime? How many of them are in the middle, and how many oppose the regime? And where does the center of gravity lie, and what's their feeling towards Israel and the West?
Well, I think the Islamic Republic is wildly unpopular at home. The vast majority are against the regime. I think there's only a core minority of supporters right now who are dependent in many respects on the Islamic Republic economically in some cases, but also there are people who share that ideological persuasion with the Supreme Leader. And so that's the dynamic. There is a unbridgeable chasm between state and society in Iran right now. And so I think then when people, you know, say that, you know, if Israel were to launch a military strike on the Islamic Republic, that there will be this rally around the flag effect, I think that that's not true in Iran today. I think Iran today is looking past the Islamic Republic, wants it gone. And and we see this on the streets as well. I think it's incredible, some of the video and photos that come out on social media of Iranians hanging the Israeli flag from Tehran highway overpasses, and you see graffiti on the walls that asking Israel to bomb certain targets that are connected to the regime. There was an Iranian who, I would say a year or so ago, in a Western article, who was interviewed anonymously and was asking the West to bomb the Beit Rahbari, which is the office of the Supreme Leader. So that sentiment is very real, and it's out there.
Right. So if there are any Iranian citizens listening to this podcast, we love you. We're with you. We want to get rid of the regime too. You know, not we, but you know what I mean.
Yes.
Okay. So let's talk about the Iranian economy. Can you just map out for me briefly what it's like and what the effects of the sanctions have been on it? I mean, it's my understanding that the whole thing is geared really towards military adventures overseas.
Yeah, I think that the Iranian rial is hitting record lows right now. It has crashed, and the economy has been hobbled by years of sanctions. The regime has found ways, ingenious ways, to circumvent these sanctions. And it has become so adept at it that it has been teaching Russia how to do the same given the invasion of Ukraine. So that is a very big, that is definitely what the economy is like in the Islamic Republic. I think it's kleptocratic. There is extreme corruption in the Islamic Republic. You have there was a Friday prayer leader of Tehran, Qasem Zadighi, who was recently implicated in a corruption scandal. And it goes all the way to the top in the Supreme Leader's office. It can be compared to a mafia, if you will, in different families and factions that are all competing with each other for different slices of the Iranian state. And that is kind of the dynamic.
Right. And what's the economy constituted of? So you've got oil production, and then you've got, I suppose, agriculture and some industry?
Yeah. Oil production, energy, agriculture, other kinds of industry, service industries. Those are some of the broad. We have their steel industry. So those are some of the ones that I would point out.
And in terms of the oil exporting, one of the ways in which the Iranians have been able to evade sanctions is by the Americans allowing them to recently, by turning a blind eye and failing to enforce sanctions as part of some misguided attempts to offer sweeteners to get them into a new nuclear deal. For example, it's been allowed to sell oil to China, allowing it to produce and sell something like 2 million barrels a day recently, I believe.
Yeah, at United Against Nuclear Iran, we've calculated that since 2021, the regime has been able to earn over $90 billion in oil sales. And that is all while sanctions have been in place technically. And it's because of lax U.S. oil sanctions enforcement in particular. And that has been a real challenge because the United States is resourcing the regime at a time when it's trying to isolate it. And I think that the president and the Biden administration likely feels pressure not only to crack down on the, you know, sanctions, because this has been a subject of a lot of scrutiny on Capitol Hill, but at the same time, it's an election year, and he doesn't want gas prices to increase. And so if the United States were to go after Chinese banks, Chinese refineries, Chinese state institutions, that would create a complication and an election year for the president and make him vulnerable. So I do think that that's part of the calculus. Right now, Yuani has been encouraging the administration to all those entities, and I think we need to do it because of this extreme national security situation that we find ourselves in at the moment.
Right. Although the sanctions relief, or not relief, because the Americans have been circumventing their own legislation with regard to sanctions to enable them to give the Iranians, you know, billions upon billions of dollars. That's been taking place really under the, that's a Biden thing, isn't it? Under Trump, there was maximum pressure and that wasn't happening. Yeah. So it's been happening for a long time under Biden.
It's been happening since 2021. Yeah, it's been happening there. And I think that, but there are also, I would say, there are structural issues in the economy and in the way the world has changed since 2013 to 15. You know, no longer are the P5 plus one a coherent entity on Iran. You know, the United States and the E3, yes, are on the same page, more or less. But China and Russia, because of great power competition and Russia's decision to invade Ukraine, have created fissures in that P5 plus one coalition that originally banded together to produce the Iran nuclear deal of 2015. So there's that element as well.
I see. Okay, so we've got an understanding of the security apparatus, the leadership structure, the ideology, and so forth. But before we go on to talk about the military capabilities and how that's going to be, how that's been harnessed in service of this ideology, can you talk about the position of Israel within the ideological structure? Because it seems like there's a real obsession with Israel that seems out of all proportion with the, you know, the fact that it doesn't share a border with Iran. It's quite a long way away. It's not, the Iranians aren't Arabs. They're not, you know, it seems kind of bewildering from the outside.
Iran has a long, proud history of close relations with Israel. Many of your viewers may not be familiar with the history, but before 1979, Israeli prime ministers traveled to Iran secretly. Golda Meir traveled to Iran. Yitzhak Rabin traveled to Iran. It's in the memoirs of Asadollah Alam, who was the court minister for the Shah at the time, and it's all recorded there. And it's just extraordinary. And Israel and Iran cooperated over water technology, agriculture, also with the very sophisticated defense cooperation with the Jericho missile. This all goes back many, many years, and there is no natural reason for why Israel and Iran should be enemies. They should be friends right now. But the problem is, as I said before, the Islamic Republic is really an aberration in Iranian history, and that is has been to the tragic detriment of not only to Israelis, but most importantly, the Iranian people, because they have been crippled in their ability to have meaningful lives and get to their full potential because of the regime's stifling ideology. But I would say that being anti-Israel and anti-Semitic, those are the core pillars of the regime. It's anti-Israel, hijab, and anti-Americanism. Those are the three core pillars that drive the Islamic Republic.
And what's the reason for that? I mean, is it to do with this idea that a war with Israel will spark the myth of the apocalypse? Is it to do with that, or is it something else?
That's an organizing principle for the regime, especially its ideologues. Absolutely. I think that there is an anti-imperialism, anti-colonial mindset of the regime that often finds itself having parallel and complementary views to some progressive elements in the West, and it tries to make inroads in that regard as well. That's an undercover aspect of the Islamic Republic's modus operandi, I would add. But that is definitely part of the core ideology of the regime.
Right. Yeah, I've been thinking since last Saturday that it's only a matter of time before we hear chants on our streets of Iran, Iran, make us proud. But let's not go there. So the regime's military capabilities, what are they?
The regime is inferior in terms of conventional military capabilities. It cannot compete with the big powers of the region like Israel, Saudi Arabia, and other rivals in terms of conventional capacities, especially because Iran's been under sanctions for such a long period of time. So to compensate for the lack of a conventional capability, Iran has invested ingeniously, I might add, in drone and missile technology to compensate for that disadvantage. And that has been really the crown jewels of the Islamic Republic's military, those products. And now we're seeing Iran, because of the expiration of UN Security Council Resolution 2231's arms embargo and missile restrictions recently, that was a conscious policy decision, sadly, by the E3 in the United States, but we can get into that later. That has been allowed to expire, and now Iran is shopping and hawking its military products to a whole range of countries in South America, Africa, Eurasia, Russia as well. So it is becoming a global, it's developing a global arms footprint beyond, well beyond the Middle East.
Right, and just a few figures that I'm that have been in my mind recently, so they may be wrong, but they're going to be roughly correct. The American economy is about 31 times the size of Iran. The Iranian military, as I recall, is ranks 14th in the world compared to America, obviously, is the first. The American Navy is four times the size of the Iranian Navy. I think the American defense budget is, what, $700, $800 billion. The Iranian one is something like $9 billion. The Israeli defense budget is something like $23 billion, something like that. And in terms of planes in the Air Force, the Iranians have 511, and the Americans have thousands, like 13,000 or something like that. So that gives you a sense of the scale.
And they're aging aircraft. The Iranians right. have aging aircraft, and a lot of them are from belong in a museum. So, right. Because from the era of the Shah.
But then, as you've said, the Iranians are embracing this low-tech approach with drones that are cheap. I mean, we saw on Saturday the defense of Israel cost Israel alone, without even taking into account the spending of the allies, $1 billion that one night, defending against cheap drones. Yeah.
And the United States has spent an inordinate amount of sum of money shooting down Houthi missiles and drones, which are based on Iranian technology, in the Red Sea area. And it has, as I said, it's an ingenious way of building or projecting power in the region through missiles and drones.
So before we start talking about their nukes or lack thereof, just tell me about the Ring of Fire strategy.
Sure. The Ring of Fire strategy has was birthed really by Qasem Soleimani. It was birthed and expanded by him when he was the commander of the IRGC's Quds Force. And the Ring of Fire is meant to surround Israel from around its borders to gradually make life unlivable and unbearable in Israel. And that has been the Islamic Republic's strategy for a very long period of time. They don't aim in a big bang to take out Israel. They aim to do it death by a thousand cuts, if you will. But it has become much more aggressive in the post from October 7th on because of two reasons. One is because for the first time in the post October 7th context, Iran has been deploying the full slate of its proxies and partners in a Gaza conflict targeting Israel. In previous Gaza conflicts before October 7th, there was only symbolic participation from Hezbollah, the Houthis, Iraq militias, Syrian militias that are connected to the IRGC. But post October 7th, we have seen the Axis of Resistance, which are Iran's proxies and partners, be deployed in an unprecedented manner, expansive and in a coordinated manner. And that is really the legacy of Qasem Soleimani's successor, Ismail Ghani, who is really been the mastermind behind the coordination of all these different players. And that's where his legacy comes in here. So that's the first reason. The second reason, again, and as we saw this weekend, is for the first time since 1979, the Islamic Republic launched a direct attack against Israel from Iranian soil. So it is becoming much more aggressive in implementing its Ring of Fire strategy than it had been in the pre-October 7th context.
Right. So the Ring of Fire is about positioning these proxies around Israel in this ring. And it strikes me that Iran really, its strategy is one of increments, isn't it? It's seeing how far it can push the line and what it can get away with. And the implications are that right now, at the moment, with all this pressure on Israel not to respond to that attack on Saturday, if it doesn't do so, from the Iranians' point of view, that will be the new normal.
Exactly. I think the most important statement of the flurry of comments that have come out of Tehran and the region and in the West about the situation in Israel was from the commander-in-chief of the IRGC, Hossein Salami, who boasted after April 13th about a new equation with Israel. And that is something that is unacceptable to the Israeli officials in the security establishment, where Iran would be launching attacks from Iranian soil instead of operating through proxies and partners in its various theaters around the region against Israel. And so Israel cannot let that stand. It must respond. It has an obligation to its people to respond. And so that's why I think that the portrayal of what happened on April 13th as a win for Israel is grossly overstated and gross political spin, because it wasn't a win. I think questions have to be asked in the West as to why Ayatollah Khamenei felt emboldened enough to feel comfortable that he can launch an attack against from Iranian soil against Israel for the first time since 1979. So I don't think it was a pure win, as the Biden administration and also Rishi Sunak have been saying. The defense performance of the interceptions was absolutely an achievement, but I think it's a gross overstatement to say it was a win for Israel.
Right. So, I mean, we're speaking now before any Israeli response has happened. It may be that this goes out and people will be listening and thinking, my goodness, you didn't know what was going to come. If that's the case, we can only apologize. But we're giving lots of useful context either way. So this is the incremental strategy that Iran has been pursuing, with the acquiescence of the appeasing Biden administration, so far as it seems to me, over the last few years. And it reminds me of a couple of lines from Saul Bellow's book, To Jerusalem and Back, that he wrote after the Yom Kippur War, where he said that you get the feeling that Israel is something like an insecure tooth on which the Russians or the Iranians don't choose to use the pincers. They will work it back and forth, and when it's sufficiently loose, they will take it out with their fingers. It's that kind of approach, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just extraordinary, some of the commentary that I'm reading, and also things coming out of the Biden administration, that, Israel has to be restrained in its response. It can't escalate tensions. If the United States was subject to a drone and missile swarm from Mexico, let's say, hypothetically, do you think that there would be demands in this country or elsewhere from the international community that the United States take the win, assuming they were all intercepted, and not respond to restore deterrence? It's absurd. So, I think that we have to look at it in that context. Israel should not be made to be subject to some kind of different standard than any other country in the international system.
Right. But it seems to me that the one sort of bit of their military strategy that the Iranians have that isn't perhaps entirely incremental, or won't be if it's ever achieved, is the nuclear project. Now, Nadav Ayal, the Israeli journalist who writes for Yediot Ahronot, a couple of weeks ago broke the story that after October the 7th, during the war in Gaza, the Iranians were seeking to create or to purchase a trigger system that would set off a nuclear weapon. How close are we to Iranian nuclearization?
Well, we're creeping closer, and that's a very disturbing report. I would say it's sadly consistent with the activities of an entity in Iran that have often gone overlooked in Western media coverage and conscious. Conscious is the Organization for Defensive Innovation and Research, SPND, which Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, who Israel assassinated a few years ago, oversaw. And that is, he was the father of Iran's nuclear weapons program. And there, you know, the U.S. intelligence community and European governments like to always say that Iran is not currently undertaking the core activities that would be necessary to produce a testable nuclear device. But the SPND entity has been reorganized after Iran stopped its nuclear weapons program in 2003 to undertake dual-use research and development activities where thousands of employees who used to work on Iran's nuclear weapons program before it paused it were reorganized into this entity, and they have tried to procure, under the guise of dual-use technology, instruments and other kinds of goods that would be useful for in the development of a nuclear weapon. And that's what makes this very dangerous, because there's no visibility into this aside from the intelligence community, and that's what we have to be watching very closely.
I mean, I've seen conflicting reports. One report said that Iran has enough fissile material for a bomb, for one warhead, and is now working on weaponization, i.e. making it shootable on a missile, and that will take a number of months. I've seen another report saying that it's a week away from that stage. I've seen a further report saying that it has enough fissile material for three warheads. What's your understanding of the state of play?
Well, it has enough fissile material for the three warheads. That's for sure. But I think that what we have to look at is there is the breakout timeline, which is very, very short, very, very the window is very tight right now there, and how long it would take to create a delivery vehicle that's operational with the fissile material. And so that would take the system much longer. Some estimates are 6 months, some estimates are a year and a half. So I think that we have to break it down that way. But again, SPND, as I mentioned before, has been a black box. Because inspections of those kinds of facilities connected to SPND were not part of the nuclear deal that was inked in 2015. And that was, one of the flaws of that agreement.
It seems to me that if you put all of this together, the incompetence, corruption, and fanaticism of the leadership, the ideology that is based around the apocalypse giving way to a messianic age, the pursuit of nuclear weapons and how they've been so deceptive over the years in pushing forward with that development by increments. It seems that I'm not confident in saying that they wouldn't use those nukes if they were to get them.
Well, I think that there are different schools of thought on that. I think that there are some observers who view Iran as wanting to achieve a Japan-like capability of being just a screwdriver turn away from nuclear weapons, and that's where it is really now. But there are others who believe that Iran wants to get a nuclear weapon and would use it, and even if it didn't use it, just the fact that Iran would have one would create, reset the entire deterrence equation in the Middle East. It would make Iran more aggressive. It would encourage proliferation across the region, Saudi Arabia, elsewhere. And so that's what makes this all very dangerous. And I don't think that Ayatollah Khamenei can be trusted with a nuclear arsenal, given the regime's ideology and its aggressive behavior at home and abroad.
So what does America and the international community do about this? I mean, it seems to me that I've been quite scathing of the Biden administration's appeasement of the Iranians since he came to power, and all the key landmarks in the development of a nuclear weapon, i.e. enrichment to 20% to 60% and so forth, were achieved under on Biden's watch. What needs to be done now? I mean, in an ideal...
I think the Biden administration's Iran policy has been a disaster from 2021 forward. We started out trying to return to mutual compliance with the JCPOA, but the Iranian regime dragged out the talks. It took advantage of the stated willingness of the Biden administration and the emphasis on diplomacy to expand its nuclear program. Iran took the greatest leaps ever in its nuclear program under the Biden administration. Those are facts. It decided to enrich uranium to an unprecedented 60%, and it installed advanced centrifuges. And the Biden administration has ownership of that, irrespective of the Trump administration withdrawing. Actually, after the Trump administration withdrew, Iran took very gradual, reversible steps. But post the November 2020 elections, they grew the nuclear program by leaps and bounds. And so I think that the U.S. posture has been quite weak, and the absence of deterrence emboldened the Iranian regime to continue to test international red lines. So the JCPOA effort collapsed. And then the Biden administration tried to problem solve by coming up with these informal diplomatic understandings that were never written, never disclosed to the American people or Congress, and that tried to problem solve that way in the name of de-escalation to keep the Iran file off the president's desk so that they could focus on China, Ukraine, and also trying to normalize relations between Israel and Saudi Arabia. But that also effort failed, especially in the post-October 7th context. And the Biden administration's Iran, special envoy for Iran, Rob Malley, has been on leave, suspended because his security clearance was revoked. We don't have any details about that. And so I think it's, as I said, it's been a mess from 2021 forward. So that's where we are today. And Iran's nuclear program is at a very advanced stage. I believe the Biden administration needs to work with the E3 to invoke the snapback sanctions mechanism under UN Security Council Resolution 2231. That would reset the entire table with Iran. It would bring back all the old Security Council resolutions like 1929, which actually mandated zero enrichment for the Iran's nuclear program. It seems like ages ago, but if your listeners will recall, the Iran nuclear deal permitted enrichment up to 3.67%. It would reinstate the arms embargo. It would reinstate the missile restrictions, which, oh, by the way, would be helpful given Iran's increasing arms to Russia for use against Ukraine. So snapback would be a very important move, as it would psychologically shape the Iranian calculus and lull them out of a sense of complacency that they've had that no matter what they do, the international community will still be at the table trying to get them to agree to some kind of deal. So that's what they need to do. We also need to start isolating Iran diplomatically and building a global coalition that's willing to take risks and willing to take tangible, meaningful measures to isolate the regime. And only the United States can start leading in this regard. This is what you see Israeli leaders trying to say, where we're talking about a global alliance. I've heard this before for years, but it has never come through because of a lack of willpower and motive and for the U.S. to engage in this, especially under the Biden administration. But we need to be actively doing that. And last and certainly not least, we need a credible military threat. I think the United States should join Israel in these strikes in Iran, because that would rebuild the American deterrence equation with Iran that has been very, very badly and dangerously eroded over years, not just the Biden administration. This is a product of Republican and Democratic failings on Iran policy. And so that would help deterrence on the nuclear side as well, because Iran knows the U.S. has the capability of taking out its entire nuclear program, but it doubts we have the will to do so. And if the U.S. demonstrated a will to strike inside Iran with Israel, that would really change the regime's calculus.
Right. Well, let's just finish by talking a little bit about Donald Trump, because I couldn't help but compare the Biden administration's response. I mean, you know, we mustn't take any credit away from Joe Biden in orchestrating this fantastic display of might, defensive might, 99% success rate over the skies of Israel on Saturday. And yet it contrasts heavily with the appeasement since 2021, and also the rhetoric since, which is focusing not on Iran or Hamas, but on Israel, telling Israel not to respond and not to escalate anything further, i.e. enforce any kind of deterrent. I compared that to Donald Trump's tweet in 2020 after the killing of Qasem Soleimani. And I mean, this just takes you back. I mean, he wrote on Twitter, "Let this serve as a warning, capital letters, that if Iran strikes any Americans or American assets, we have targeted 52 Iranian sites representing the 52 American hostages taken by Iran many years ago, some at a very high level and important to Iran and the Iranian culture. And those targets and Iran itself, capital letters, will be hit very fast and very hard." I mean, that's a change of rhetoric, isn't it? I mean, it's no surprise that Iran didn't retaliate for the killing of Qasem Soleimani in any dramatic or meaningful way.
Donald Trump understood leverage, how to build leverage, and how to put the fear of God into the Islamic Republic's leadership. Right now, we have a president who can barely speak about Iran because he's uncomfortable speaking about it. And that is a huge change. The president has, Biden, has never given a substantive set of remarks about Iran in his entire presidency. So I think that's a striking contrast. I would say this, I think we have to be careful when we speak of military action against the Islamic Republic. We are not targeting the Iranian people, Iranian culture, Iranian heritage. We're targeting the Islamic Republic and the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. So I think that that, just in terms of messaging and targeting, it's important because we have to also be, the audience is not just the regime. We need the Iranian people. We need the Iranian people because they are the greatest allies, I think, of the West. And they, that dialogue between the Iranian people and the Biden administration and European governments has not been in existence, but it needs to happen. And if we start talking about cultural sites and those kinds of targets, that is, first of all, that would be a huge error. And I think we have to avoid that.
I mean, that's typical Trump, isn't it? Sort of, you know, kind of erratic and uncontrolled. But I think that the main thing is this aggression, which seemed to serve as a deterrent. I mean, did, you know, when Trump pulled out of the JCPOA in 2018, do you think that was the right decision? And after that, until the end of his presidency, until the Biden administration began, was he successful in trying to repress Iranian progress toward a bomb?
I believe it was the right decision. I believe that that deal was fatally flawed. My organization, United Against Nuclear Iran, was against it from the very moment of its existence because we knew that it wouldn't meaningfully stop Iran from achieving a nuclear weapon. We knew that the assumptions upon which the deal was based were faulty about how it would give Iran time to evolve and reform itself. Reform is not possible under the Islamic Republic, and it's not on the menu. As long as Khamenei is alive and as long as the regime is the regime, it's never going to reform. So I think that we have to get the language of reform out of Washington and European capitals. It's just a fantasy and never going to happen. I also think that it was based on an assumption that, Iran would be willing to negotiate longer and stronger in the future and wider as well in non-nuclear contexts. And that is also, I think, has been proven untrue. The regime has viewed the nuclear deal with the West as the ceiling of its engagement, and the West has always viewed it as the floor. And that mismatch in objectives would always make any diplomatic arrangement with Iran faulty and unsteady. And so that's what we have to keep in mind, I think.
But then during the Trump presidency, after pulling out of the JCPOA, that didn't solve the problems either.
Well, I think that it deprived the regime of revenue. It deprived attacks, because it didn't have the lethality of attacks decreased because it didn't have the revenue. So that saved lives in the region. And I think that that's missing a lot of times from the equation, from the conversation on the JCPOA. So Iran, Islamic Republic with more resources can invest in more missiles and drones and supply them around the world. And also, oh, by the way, even without the restriction, when the restrictions that would have been lifted on all those programs because of the UN Security Council Resolution 2231 sunset clauses, that would contribute to a more lethal Iran in the non-nuclear context. And the JCPOA took the most important tools that the U.S. arsenal, economic warfare arsenal, in terms of the energy sanctions, off the table. So that's why it was fundamentally flawed, in my view.
Right. So Trump's policy of maximum pressure helped to rein in Iran in terms of its influence over the region. But did it help to slow down or to halt Iran's progress towards a nuclear warhead?
I think that the Trump administration, Iran, expanded its nuclear program after the withdrawal. Those are facts. But as I said before, these were reversible, gradual steps, didn't result in a war. But when the Biden administration took over, given its posture towards Iran, those advancements in the nuclear program skyrocketed and went like rocket fire. So that distinction and that difference is where I think the mistakes were made in 2021 when the Biden administration took office. They should have continued the maximum pressure campaign, and I think we would have been in a much better place today.
Right. So lastly, Jason, just throw us forward a little bit and forecast over the next period. We've got an election, American election in November, that Trump is widely expected to win, but you can't count on that. What do you think would be the best outcome over the next year vis-a-vis Iran?
Well, I'm not a partisan person. We're a strictly nonpartisan organization. I think we need a bipartisan Iran policy in the United States, a completely new one. And I don't see any work being done in the government to achieve that. I think we have a lot of policy disorientation at the moment. I've been an advocate of creating a blue ribbon or a bipartisan commission on Capitol Hill, similar to what we have with China. We have a Chinese bipartisan commission in Congress, which is tasked with developing a long-term strategy for how to deal with the Chinese Communist Party. We need the same with Iran. And it needs to be bipartisan. There need to be Democrats and Republicans, independents at the table with the administration coming up with a consensus, because I think that the problem is in many respects, Washington has not been able to generate a consensus on what an acceptable Iran strategy looks like. And that's why the JCPOA collapsed, because of that lack of domestic political consensus. So I think we all need to come to the table. Those people who are on the progressive side and were supporters of the JCPOA need to stop, with the name calling and the slogans about hawks and war. Also on the Republican side as well, we need to start making more of an outreach to the Biden administration and trying to build bridges there, coming up with a strategy where we are coming up with a Iran plan that meets our national interests and protects our allies as well. And so that's what I think should be job one in the coming months. But I don't see any effort being made in this regard. And that's why it's very concerning to me.
Right. Well, on that worrying note, Jason, thank you very much. Thank you to the listeners of our podcast for tuning in and the viewers of this on YouTube as well. But most of all, thank you to you, Jason, for joining us. And I hope you'll join us again soon when we have hopefully better news and some kind of Iran strategy to talk about.
Thank you, Jake. It's great to be with you.
You've been listening to the Israel War Briefing from the Jewish Chronicle, with me, Jake Wallace-Simons. Join us next time for more insight and analysis from leading experts.